I don't know what to say about all of that. I really don't. I'm happy to be here. I was asked to come, and about a year ago, I guess it was, David Baker called me up on the phone and asked if I would be here. And he said, we got some other people doing some other things. Why don't you do something biblical? And I said, that sounds fine. Could you narrow that down a little bit? I said, you know, almost like a proud father, I said, look, I'm going to have a book coming out about the time that conference is meeting. Could we do something on Easter? He said, why don't we do something practical? He said, it's a professional leaders conference, and if you could do something biblical, that would be practical. And he suggested something like this. This is almost a quotation out of one of his letters after we'd had a couple of phone calls. How our living Lord, that's the Easter part, and I guess the biblical part, relates to us in terms of our age of fears and anxieties and hopes and dense pack and MX missiles. It was at that point that I almost backed out. But then I said, well, how would this be if we pick a gospel, and since next year I think the basic gospel lessons come out of Matthew, I said, why don't we take a gospel, namely Matthew's gospel, and try to concentrate as much as we can on the Easter portion of Matthew's gospel and see if somehow or other that material would help us in terms of our own lives and situations and the kinds of things that we confront in congregations and as citizens. And so what I would like to do in three sessions would be to talk this morning with you about Matthew's situation. What was his world like? What kinds of issues did he and his community face? Second session, I'd like to talk about Matthew's faith, that is, his Lord. How does he voice his faith in the living Lord? And do we voice our faith in the same way, parallel way, a different way, and so on? And then in a third session, talk about Matthew's vision of the church, namely, how does Matthew see the task that is set before the church, and can we march under the same set of orders that Matthew felt himself marching under? So something like that. Matthew's situation this morning, Matthew's faith or Lord tomorrow morning, and then the following morning something on Matthew's vision of the task of the church. I think it's something like that that I would like to do. And I don't know, there's all kinds of different ways of trying to get started at this thing. But one of the things that occurred to me was that I could say something about these things that I just put up on the board. I don't know if you can see that in red. Maybe I should have used another color. Can't see it? Want to sit up here? Should I move these along? Is another color better?
Yeah.
See, now it'll be bad for you people over on that side. No, it's too far? What I would like to do is something like this. I heard that old cliche so many times about what a preacher ought to do. A preacher ought to be a person who every day reads the Bible and the daily newspaper. And I've heard that so darn many times, and I tried to think, what's wrong with that caricature of a preacher's work? And I every once in a while, a seminary professor has an idea, and the idea that I had about what's wrong with that cliche is that the biblical writers themselves, the evangelists themselves, are already preachers who have done that kind of thing. Namely, they have contemplated the tradition of the gospel which has reached them, and meditated upon the gospel and upon the situation in which they lived. So when we read the gospels, we're not just reading God's word kind of pure, but what we're reading are old sermons. The gospels are old sermons because the gospel writers are old preachers. And what I would like to do is try to take a look at these old sermons with you and see if we can learn anything about our own sermonizing and our own communicating of the gospel in our own world. Now, what I would like to do, in other words, is use a piece of Matthew's gospel. The pieces that I would like to concentrate on, really, are birth and infancy narrative of all things, and that's about 48 verses. That's 48 verses in Matthew's gospel, a total of about 1,048 verses in Matthew's gospel. About 4.5% of his gospel is birth and infancy narrative. From Palm Sunday down to the resurrection is about 36% of his gospel. And the particular piece that I would like to focus on together with birth and infancy narrative is about 25 verses here at the end of the gospel, and try to say something about how does his proclamation of Easter have anything to say to us in our situation. So there's a couple of things that I'm going to try to do and a couple of things I'm going to try not to do. I don't want to talk about what happened on April the 9th in the year 30. I don't want to talk directly about Easter, directly about the historical event, what happened on the first Easter morning. That's a very important question, but that's not the one that I would like to focus on. There is an oral period in which the message of the death and resurrection of Jesus was transmitted by word of mouth. Things began to get written down. Usually people say that the so-called Q document, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, was written down in the 50s, consists of somewhat more than 200 verses. Mark's gospel is about 661 verses, probably written in the late 60s. Some people say the early 70s. Matthew's gospel, who knows when it was written, in the 80s, the 90s of the first century. Luke's gospel, a little bit longer. Of course, Luke Acts, we shouldn't really leave Acts out of the picture, volume 1 and 2 of a single work. That is probably also written in the 80s or 90s independently of Matthew. Luke Acts together makes up about 27% of the New Testament. He wrote more of it than any other single author. We give the Gospel of John a star over here. It's a little shorter, about 879 verses. Now, what I do not want to do, is try to ransack these Gospels, these writings, and penetrate through them back to whatever may have happened at the first Easter. A lot of people do that, and it's certainly legitimate and useful, but I don't want to do that. What I want to do is just concentrate on Matthew's Gospel itself and just ask, how does he use the story of the resurrection of Jesus, which he believed? He has received the tradition of the resurrection of Jesus. He believes it, and he is reissuing it in his own time because of the situation in which he lives. He's trying to put the resurrected Jesus to work. He's putting the resurrected Jesus to work in his own situation. And it's that I would like to talk about, how he puts the living Lord to work, how the Easter Christ functions in the thought of Matthew. I suppose that's kind of the overall topic that I would like to get at. And as I say, first off this morning, talk with you about the world of Matthew. And again, now there's a lot of ways of trying to get at the world of Matthew, huh? We could take a look at Dead Sea Scrolls, look at Josephus, look at all of the biblical writings, look at all of the stuff that the archaeologists have dug up and try to get a profile of the world that Matthew lived in. But that's not what I want to do. What I would want to do is this instead. Just by thinking about Matthew's gospel, ask the question, what does Matthew say about the world that Matthew lived in? How does he perceive the world that he lives in? You and I all describe our world differently from one another. In some perhaps significant respects, we view the world differently from one another, even though it's supposed to be the same world in which we live. And there are people who we say can describe the world better than other people describe the world. But we're just ask, how does Matthew envision the world in which he lives? I don't think it's an easy topic. And so to get at an answer, I think we would need to do certain kinds of work. And we're not going to do all of that work this morning. But let me suggest to you what assignments I would give you to discover the answer to that question. How does Matthew envision the world in which he lives? Let me suggest to you the assignments, the exercises that I would give to you. We'll do one or two of them, but not all of them. If we really wanted to focus on that world that he lives in, the first assignment would go like this. And this is a piece, I suppose, of what today is sometimes called a social perspective or a sociological approach to biblical materials. Those of you who read exegetical journals probably are into this kind of thing. But for those of you who are not, let me just suggest that this is the kind of thing that very many professors at seminaries like to do these days. It's proved to be somewhat helpful. Say a first assignment, okay, and this is one that we will not carry through with any kind of thoroughness this morning. Say, read the Gospel of Matthew and just make a list. And this is kind of artificial, but say anything that he has to say about social life. Okay, any glimmer of Matthew's awareness of what's happening in his society. And right away you know that he does have stuff to say about marriage, divorce, adultery, celibacy, gluttony, drunkenness. But anything that he has to say about what we might call social life, you just make a list of all of that kind of material. Relationships between parents and children, social life. A second list under the same assignment would be to read the gospel and ask, what does he say about economic life? And I think that Matthew's description of economic life is fuller than Mark's, by far, probably fuller also than Luke's, far fuller than anything that John has to say. He has a fuller, richer awareness of the church existing in the midst of an economy, a world that is organized economically. Talks about money. All of the Gospels talk about money changers. Talks about tenant farmers, sharecroppers, absentee owners leaving behind certain capital funds for servants or stewards to invest in their absence, wanting them to put it out at interest. That's common material to at least three of the Gospels. Matthew alone has the parable in which the fellow comes out of his vineyard at the first hour, the second hour, the third hour, the fourth hour of the day, finds all these folks just hanging around in a marketplace hoping that somebody's going to hire them, and then has that peculiar scheme for paying them at the end of the day. Matthew alone has that one. And I guess I would pay special attention as I would do this assignment to the unique features of Matthew's gospel. I'd probably try to do it with a synopsis in front of me and see where does Matthew differ from the other Gospels. But that would be a second kind of list that I would have you make to see how much is Matthew aware of the economic life of the people with whom he is living. And maybe a third list would be politics and political life. What's Matthew's awareness of the political system? How does he feel about, what does he say about politics, and how does he feel about politicians, political life? There's an enormous amount of material in Matthew's gospel, and a little bit in a couple of minutes. As a matter of fact, what I'd like to do is have us look at his portrait of a couple of rulers, of Herod and of Pilate. But a first assignment, and I really do commend this to you, would be to, you know, sit down sometime as you're going to read through Matthew's gospel and preach through Matthew's gospel next year, and just simply make lists. So do a close reading of Matthew's gospel and make lists concerning social life, economic life, and political life. We'll say something about religious life in a couple of minutes. But that would be a first assignment. I don't want to draw too many conclusions from that. I haven't even done that as carefully myself as I am encouraging you to do. But it's a task that that I do want to do one of these days soon. In John's gospel, and this would be a contrast now, in John's gospel I have noticed that there are no children. There are no poor people. There are no tax collectors. There are no prostitutes. There are no Sadducees. There are no Herodians. There are no lepers. There are no demon-possessed people. And so the portrait that John, I'm talking about John for a minute, and that's contrast to the kinds of things I find in Matthew's gospel. John's gospel is going to talk about Jesus differently from the way in which Matthew talks about Jesus. Inevitably, because all kinds of images are not present. All kinds of relationships are eliminated from the portrait that John paints of Jesus. In Mark's gospel, Jesus is primarily busy in rural areas, and the city seems to be a place that Jesus avoids. And the city is a place of conflict. The city is the place of opposition to Jesus. But reading the political list in Matthew's gospel, as I went, you know, go through that kind of thing, Matthew simply uses the word polis, city, 26 times. Mark only uses it 8 times. Yeah, a little, you know, statistic probably can't tell us too much. But Matthew seems to feel differently about the city from the way in which Mark feels about the city. It's a natural and normal place for Jesus to be present and to be at work. It is not just a place of opposition as it is in Mark. That's one way to try to get at, that's assignment number one, that's one way to try to get at Matthew's own view of the situation in which he and the folks to whom he is ministering and with whom he is living, view their life, their world, their situation. A second assignment. Just read the birth and infancy narratives of Matthew and Luke. Read their birth and infancy narratives. Read the first two chapters of Matthew and read the first two chapters of Luke. And ask yourself, how do they differ in tone, in mood, in atmosphere? Yeah, it's a very subjective kind of thing. I'll give you a couple of conclusions that I come to, and maybe you feel differently about it. Luke's gospel seems to me to be full of peace, light, joy, awe, wonder, worship. Zechariah in the temple, the angel appearing to Mary, let it be to me according to your word. Mary meeting Elizabeth. The child leaps in Elizabeth's womb. The naming of John. The canticles, which we still use at matins and vespers. Jesus celebrated by the angels, a mighty host, not of warring angels, but of singing angels, greets the birth of the child. Shepherds gather round. Up to the temple, Anna and Simeon. And then the 12-year-old Jesus in Luke 2, 41 to 52 is down there conversing, dialoguing with the doctors in the temple. It's Luke's birth and infancy narrative. Matthew's is darker. Much darker, much gloomier, much heavier, full of conflict. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 to 17 is the genealogy. Even the genealogy is different. Luke's list is boring. The son of blank, 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 the son of Adam, the son of God. Well, that may be very important. He's trying to define what son of God is, but it's kind of a boring list. Matthew's list is different, but it's not boring. It's different. It's a different list. Full of wild people, full of wild people. You know all about them. We all drag those people out every once in a while from that genealogy. Tamar, Rahab, the harlot, the wife of Uriah gets into the act. I once said to a Bible class, boy, that's a bunch of pretty bad gals, huh? And some woman in the group said, yeah, well, those guys aren't so hot either, you know. it's a wild bunch. It's full of life. It's full of real life, that list. And four times he talks about the deportation to Babylon, you know, the collapse of the Judahite kingdom, the destruction of the temple. You get all those pictures from Jeremiah in your mind four times at one of the major breakpoints in Matthew's telling of the genealogy. He talks about exile to Babylon, the deportation to Babylon. So 1 to 17 is the genealogy, and it's full of real life and real people, you know, warts and all. 18 to 25 is the Annunciation, not to Mary as in Luke's Gospel, but to Joseph. And it's the whole mulling over of, where is this child really from? Could this possibly be an illegitimate child? And you get the overtones of illicit sex and of juicy gossip. You can hear all of that in the background of 1:18 to 25. Chapter 2 is a wonderful chapter of the wise men coming to first of all to Jerusalem, and they meet Herod, and Herod says, well, tell me where the child is to be born. I want to go down and worship him too. And it's a lie and it's deception, and the child has to flee to Egypt with parents, and the slaughter of the innocent children in Bethlehem, all the male children 2 years old and younger. And then Herod dies, and Archelaus becomes the ruler, and Jesus is Joseph is told through the angel, when he's in Egypt, you can go back now, but don't go to Judea, you better go up north, because Archelaus isn't any better than his old man. And again, it seems to me that if you would compare those two infancy narratives, you get a different tone, a different mood, a different atmosphere, which I think is characteristic. Again, it's just comparing two figures now in Matthew's Gospel. Compare that wonderful scene in the second chapter, Herod in the second chapter, and Pilate in the second last chapter. Just compare the portrait that Matthew draws. I'm intrigued by what Matthew is doing as he writes about Herod in the beginning and Pilate at the end. Herod in the beginning, in the first 12 verses of chapter 2, is pictured as, I guess, in his audience room, at his palace, or in his administrative quarters, listening to the wise men who come looking for the child because they've seen his star. And so Herod scratches his head and he says, what the heck, why do I have religious committees? Let me get some experts in here. So the experts come in, and they explain to Herod that, prophecy says, so that they're telling Herod, and Matthew is telling the reader, that yes, the Messiah of Israel, the Savior of God's people, really is to be born not in Jerusalem, but in Bethlehem. That's what the scriptures say according to these scribes who come in to interpret God's will to Herod. So Herod and the reader are told very directly about this child. And then you get the lies and the deception and the slaughter of the innocents, in spite of the fact that Herod knows the truth. At least he's been told the truth by the highest religious authorities in the land. And I think that all of that story, or most of that, is it's all in chapter 2. Most of it's in the first 12 verses of chapter 2. The slaughter of the innocents comes a little bit later. Very similar, it seems, and that's a scene that's in Matthew's gospel only. And I'm always intrigued by the material that's in Matthew's gospel only. Out of the 10, I think it's 1,048 or 1,068. I may have turned this number around. It's 1,048, 1,006, something like that. Within 20 verses, there are about 400 verses of Matthew's gospel, which is Matthean material only. It's the so-called M material, just to put a letter on it. I'm always intrigued by the stuff that Matthew alone tells us. You know, what is it that he is handing on to his first readers and to us later readers? What is that? What's the flavor of that material? This is a scene that he alone tells. Here's another scene that he alone has, and that's in the second last chapter. And that's, again, a scene in an administrative building. It's an official hearing. Pilate is trying Jesus. And as a matter of fact, Herod was trying Jesus in chapter 2. Now Pilate, the Roman governor, prefect, is trying Jesus in the second last chapter. It's in chapter 27. It must be up around verses 18 to 25, chapter 27, about 18 to 25. So the scene is Pilate. I believe that he's described as sitting on his judgment seat. He is seated at the bema, the raised official platform from which he conducts his official business. And Jesus is there in front of him. And just as Herod in the beginning received a divine word, a word of prophecy, a word of interpretation of prophecy, so now Herod gets a strange call. It's like the wife calling up when you're at the office in the midst of a counseling session. But he gets a note, I guess, or a message from his wife. It's very strange. And his wife says, have nothing to do with that righteous man, dikaios, innocent, righteous. We'll talk about dikaios and dikaiosyne, righteous and righteousness, a little bit later on. Favorite word of Matthew's. She says, have nothing to do with that righteous man. I have suffered much because of him in a dream. Just as Joseph had all those wonderful dreams, just as the wise men had all those wonderful dreams in chapters 1 and 2. It's a vehicle, a means, a channel through which God reveals truth to people. So what Matthew is saying to his first readers, at least, is that divine revelation, not just a word from the wife, but divine revelation came to Pilate at the end, and Pilate was told by heaven, Jesus is innocent. Herod in the beginning was told by heaven Jesus really is, may really be the Bethlehem. Bethlehem certainly really is the place to expect the Messiah. But then at the end, just as you had the slaughter of the innocents in the beginning, you have the slaughter of Jesus at the end. Pilate doesn't come off any better at the end than Herod did at the beginning. A little bit later on, you get rumors and lies and deception. If you look at Matthew 28, verse 15, the guards that were set at the tomb to make sure that there wasn't going to be any resurrection, they were set there to make sure that the disciples didn't steal the body and all the rest of that. The guards who fainted dead away, when the earthquake came and the angel of the Lord descended and Jesus was resurrected, they go back to town and say, well, we couldn't help it, you know. He's resurrected anyhow. And so they sit around and they say, well, I'll tell you what to do. They get the word from the high priest that what they ought to do is go around and tell people that they fell asleep while they were on guard duty. That's odd. I mean, that really is odd for the soldiers to go around saying, well, we fell asleep when we were on guard. Well, anyway, Caiaphas said, well, I'll give you some money so that you'll be happy. And if this comes to Pilate's ears, well, I'll take care of Pilate so that he won't bother anybody. And so in 28, verse 15, Matthew says, and this story, this rumor, is spread abroad among the Jews to this very day. Now, my point at this point is simply that if you look at chapters 1 and 2, and you look at chapters 27, 28, and particularly at the figure of Herod in the beginning and Pilate at the end, I think you can see something of Matthew's attitude towards rulers, towards government, towards the world that he lived in. And if you put together the stuff from the first three assignments that I've been giving you, first one on social, economic, and political life. Second one on the tone or the mood of Matthew's birth and infancy narrative. Third one on the portraits of Herod and of Pilate. And then you would try to draw some quick conclusions. We're not talking about the religious stuff yet or what's going on inside the church or between church and synagogue. But if you just ask yourself about that material, just draw a line and say, conclusions. How does Matthew view his world? How does he feel about the life that he is living, the communities, the larger public society and economic and political institutions in which the church is set. I think you could. At least quickly, you and I could agree the guy's not naive. He's very realistic. He understands the seamier and darker and meaner side of life, as well as all of the light and the wonder and the beauty of life. He is not naive. He is not, he doesn't have his head in the clouds. He has his feet very much on the ground. He knows the sharp, hard, tough realities that people like ourselves still live in.
Is he cynical?
He's neither cynical nor optimistic. If by optimism we would mean, he's hopeful, he's full of hope, he has a gospel, he has good news to proclaim. And that's really what we want to do, is we want to talk about the good news of the resurrected Christ. How does he take the good news of the death and resurrection of Jesus, or the birth and life and death and resurrection of Jesus, how does he take that and shape it and issue it as good news? He does have good news. He is not, I think if he were, at least my definition of a cynic is somebody who sees all of that and says that that's all there is. And behind a cynic is somebody who sees a darkness behind every silver cloud. That's a cynic. You know, somebody who can always find the underside and always wants to emphasize the darker shadowy aspects of life. He's not cynical. And I'm more cynical than Matthew, I'm sure, by far. That's a problem for me. But I think that, he's not as optimistic as Luke. I think of Luke as being, I should back away from the word optimistic, I suppose. But Luke is optimistic about the chances of the church and the empire coexisting very peaceably. He's very optimistic about that. But optimism and hope are two different things. I think that Matthew is full of hope. He has a strong message of good for people who are in tough situations. But that's a piece, and that's a quickie because we haven't done those assignments. We're just talking about doing those assignments, those exercises. A fourth one, okay? A fourth exercise. This really is the last one. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this one. What's the religious situation? The religious situation in which Matthew and his community existed, lived their lives. There are two ways in which people are describing Matthew's religious situation today. And if you would look at chapter 23, maybe we can mention quickly what one of those ways of describing the religious situation is. Matthew 23 is this blast. Apparently, it's a blast at the scribe and the Pharisee. The whole chapter seems to be an unrelenting scold of the Pharisee. And I think that many, in the tradition, the exegetical tradition, the scholarly tradition, is that Matthew is writing in the 90s of the first century, defending the church from the accusations of the synagogue across the street, that he is locked in a combat representing church on the one side of the street against synagogue on the other side of the street, representing Christianity here against Judaism over there, that the Christians have been excommunicated. He is a Jewish Christian. Some have even thought of Matthew as a converted rabbi. He is a Jewish Christian in a Jewish Christian community, and he is defending the Christian message and the Christian community from the accusations of the synagogue across the street. We are the people of God. You are not the people of God. Jesus is the Messiah. You are wrong in your slanders. He really was virgin born. All that stuff that you say about illegitimacy is wrong. He really was raised from the dead. His disciples did not steal him, and so on. And chapter 23 is one of the premier examples that people point to when they want to say, when somebody asks them, well, what's the proof? What's the evidence? What are the arguments? What are the reasons why you say the church is involved in this struggle, this life and death struggle with Judaism? Because chapter 23, from beginning to end, seems to be almost embarrassing tirade against the Pharisee. And it's most of that material is in Matthew's gospel only. Woe to you Pharisees. Oh, man, the stuff that he says about the Pharisees in that chapter is just awful. And then, of course, from beginning to end, Matthew is very much interested in Torah or law or ethics or right living. And people say, yeah, that fits with this picture of Matthew trying to say that we Christians are not all libertinists or we don't live like pagans. We really live with the fulfilled law. And then Matthew's gospel, of course, has five discourses, remember? Someone wrote that terrible little thing. Let's see, how does that go? Matthew gives us five discourses. In threes and sevens, he likes his sources. He writes with an ecclesiastic bent to tell us what the Old Testament meant. It's doggerel, but there's a few little things in there that you might want to remember. I don't know. But five discourses, and some people have said he portrays Jesus as a new Moses, giving the new Pentateuch. Or Jesus goes up on the mount to teach, not on the plain as in Luke 6, but he goes up on the mount like Moses and delivers not the Ten Commandments, but the Beatitudes and the Antitheses and all the rest of the material of the Sermon on the Mount. So there's plenty of reason and why people have very frequently said and still say that Matthew's gospel reflects a religious situation in which the church is locked in a mortal combat with the synagogue across the street. But there's another possibility, naturally. I always like alternatives. I think that Matthew is primarily concerned about stuff going on inside the church. I think that he's primarily concerned about the leadership inside the church. I think that his gospel is directed primarily at what we today would call the professional leaders of the church. And he's got some problems with the leaders and the leadership style of folks inside the church. And I think that chapter 23, for example, we'll look at that in a minute, is directed against, not Pharisees, but he's saying, beware you Christian leaders that you do not fall under the same accusation that Jesus in the past leveled against Jewish leaders of the past. Here's my argumentation on this one. I begin in chapter 7, verses 15 to 23. I'd like you to look at this if you have testaments with you. I think it's worth your while to note some of these passages. The weakness of my argument is that I don't have very many passages, so this won't take too long. And I also, you know, that's a preemptive strike, you know, that I can admit that before somebody would point that out to me. But I start with chapter 7, verses 15 to 23. We're in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, getting towards the end, right? What does Jesus say? Some of this material, the first and last words of this bit, are in Matthew's gospel only. The stuff on a tree is in Luke's gospel and so on. He starts off by saying, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Beware of false Christian prophets who are out there running around in the church. They're Christians, they're in sheep's clothing, but they're going to wreck the flock. Wreck the flock. I think that Matthew is revealing to us here indirectly the religious situation in which he lives, and we know it also from other early Christian documents. There are wandering, charismatic, inspired preachers and teachers wandering from congregation to congregation. And some of them are okay, and some of them are not okay. In the Didache, remember the Didache? End of the first century, a very early Christian document, full of this kind of warning against false prophets, false Christian prophets. The Didache in one place, in chapter 11, verse 8, says, do not believe that a man is a prophet and speaks in a spirit, except he have the behavior of the Lord. An ethical test or criterion is applied to people who are claiming to be prophets, inspired teachers. In another passage, the Didache says, if a prophet in a trance, in an ecstatic trance, goes zooming off into space, and then begins to speak, in a trance, begins to speak. If the prophet, in an ecstatic trance, says, give the prophet money, he is a false prophet. Well, we know that. If a prophet stays for one day, or 2 days, or 3 days, give him hospitality. If he stays 4 days, he is a false prophet. There's a problem of people, you know, in this wonderfully complex period that we know so imperfectly in the early Christian church. We can see it in the Didache. We can see it in the First Epistle of John. First Epistle of John in chapter 4 talks about inspired teachers. Who has the Spirit? Well, every Christian has the Spirit. Every Christian is charismatic. Every Christian, and according to Matthew's gospel, prophet seems to be a word for every Christian. If it's not, then at least in chapter 10, 41 to 42, there's a list of words. Little ones, prophet, disciple, righteous person. Those four seem to be parallel, and they all seem to be descriptions of every Christian. Maybe prophet is a term for some leaders among these other Christians, but little ones, disciples, righteous person, dikaioi, and prophets seem to be used in parallel in chapter 10, 41 to 42 of Matthew's gospel. But in 1 John 4, if a prophet does not confess that Jesus has come in the flesh, there's a doctrinal criterion. If a prophet does not say that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, that's a false prophet. So he's got a doctrinal criterion for discerning who are the true prophets and who are the false prophets. But the point that I would be making is that this is a widespread problem in the early church. Abundance of gifts, abundance of gifts of the Spirit, abundance of charismatic endowments. We know from Paul that it was getting out of hand in Corinth. 7:15-23, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly of the ravening wolves, and his stuff about the trees. Then he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, when? At the end, I think, at the end. That's the same thing that folks say in chapter 25 at the great judgment scene. Lord, Lord, when did we see you hungry or naked or in prison or sick? Lord, Lord is a good confession. St. Paul says that nobody can call Jesus Lord, except he speak by the Spirit. This is inspired speech. This is inspired, correct acclamation of Jesus under the pressure of the Holy Spirit. But not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven. They will say to me, he says, hey, wait a minute, Lord, you know us. We did many mighty works in your name. We cast out demons in your name by the power of your Spirit. Jesus will say, what's his accusation in 23? His accusation is, depart from me in the, in the RSV, I think it's evildoers. In the original, it's you workers of lawlessness. Anomia, anomos, nomos, law, anomia, lawlessness. Depart, that's a Matthean word. That's a Matthean word, lawlessness. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. An ethical, moral criterion for discerning who are true and who are false prophets. And just as righteousness, dikaiosyne, is the good stuff, anomia, lawlessness, is the bad stuff. Go from 7:15 to 23 up to chapter 24. Chapter 24, verses 10 to 12. This is the parallel to the Mark 13, the little apocalypse. This is where Matthew is talking about, just as Mark had recorded that sermon of Jesus on the Mount of Olives, about the last things, you know, all the bad stuff that's going to happen in the last times. Matthew 24, 10, 11, and 12 is stuff that's in Matthew's gospel only. It's not in Mark's gospel. We got this little addition to the stuff that was in Mark's gospel. He says, I'll tell you how bad it's going to get in the last times. False prophets are going to come in the last times. And you know what those son of a guns are going to do? They're going to teach people bad stuff, et cetera, et cetera, lead many people astray. It's going to be tough in the last times. Agape will grow cold. Agape will grow cold. Anomia will be on the increase. Lawlessness will increase. Love will grow cold. And it looks like these false prophets are the folks who are propagating this stuff. Look back with me at, and I've got you jumping around, I know, but look back with me in the Beatitudes. chapter 5, beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, I think increasingly that the Beatitudes are directed at the leaders of the Matthean communities, that the Beatitudes, as Matthew reports them, they're also in, some of them are in Luke chapter 6, of course, because the Beatitudes originally came out of the Q sermon, and that's a whole other story. In chapter 5, verse 19, just to pick up on the notion still of false prophets and teachers, false teachers, this is a piece of material, the theme of the Sermon on the Mount is probably in chapter 5, verses 16 to 20, but in chapter 5, verse 19, after Jesus has said he has come not to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, then he says, woe, 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 woe to anyone who teaches, anyone who breaks the least of these commandments and teaches other people to break the least of these commandments. My simple mind says that this is the kind of thing that's happening, that he's warning about this because this is the sort of thing that's actually going on, and that the false prophets are false teachers who are breaking some of the commandments and teaching other people that they can break some of these commandments. And it goes on to say, I tell you, unless your righteousness, your dikaiosyne, exceeds that of the scribe and the Pharisee, you will never enter the kingdom of God. Just a picture now. Inspired, charismatically endowed teachers and prophets who are somehow or other relaxing the commandments and teaching other people. This reminds me, we'll come back to some passages in Matthew, this reminds me of the kind of stuff that Paul faced in Corinth. he says, look, we all speak in tongues, right? He said, I more than others and so on. So he accepts the fact that all Christians are charismatically endowed. They all have their different gifts. But the problem, he says in Corinth, is that some people are really breaking the law. Some people are breaking out into a kind of lawlessness, a libertinism. They say, what? Am I not free? This is one of the great themes of the opponents of Paul in 1 Corinthians. We're free from all of that old stuff. We're free from circumcision. We're free from the Sabbath. We're free from the food laws. We're free from the laws of cleanliness. You say, okay, so far so good. That's what we call the ceremonial stuff. But they didn't make the distinctions between ceremonial and moral and all of the rest of it. He says, why, it's I even hear that someone is living with his mother-in-law. His stepmother, I guess his stepmother. People are visiting the prostitutes and thinking nothing of it. Your slogans, am I not free? I've been liberated, we would say, from all that old-fashioned, conventional morality. And Paul was, in his way, confronting a situation, I think, like that, that confronts Matthew. And Matthew is applying an ethical test and criterion in his situation. But the situation is one in which these teachers and prophets are undermining the law. The law of righteousness, the law of the higher righteousness, which supersedes and exceeds that of scribe and Pharisee. The Beatitudes begin, blessed in Matthew, they begin, blessed are the poor in spirit. Is that to say, blessed are those who do not boast about their gifts of the Spirit? Blessed are those, not those who are arrogant about their gifts of the Spirit. That's the kind of stuff that Paul was facing. But blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Not that have poor gifts of the Spirit, but who are endowed with the Spirit, but are humble about that. Blessed are the meek. The meek. That's a Matthean, only in Matthew. That's a Matthean beatitude. That's a big word in Matthew. It occurs a few times in Matthew's gospel and in none of the other gospels. Meek. Jesus says in chapter 11, "Come to me, you who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Learn of me. I am," RSV says, "gentle." The word is meek, prais. I am meek. I am meek. Lowly of heart. Lowly of heart. Not puffed up. Not arrogant. And Jesus is portrayed, of course, as a charismatically endowed, inspired figure. Learn of me. Jesus entered the city of Jerusalem, chapter 21, verse 5, meek, says Matthew, only, and seated upon an ass and a colt, the foal of an ass, going up to obediently to give his life. Poor in spirit, meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Righteousness, not just those who hunger and thirst, but blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are those who mourn. Maybe it's mourn over their sin instead of boasting about their freedom from the law, the way the Corinthians boasted about their freedom from the law. Paul told them, you ought to be sorrowful instead of boasting, and so on. Chapter 6 of Matthew's Gospel talks about the three traditional forms of Jewish piety: prayer and almsgiving and fasting. 6 verse 1 uses the word dikaiosyne in Greek. It's translated as piety or religion in the RSV. What are the works of righteousness? Well, he says prayer and fasting and almsgiving. But in the stuff on praying, why does Matthew talk about this business of in the closet with a few words? Again, it reminds me of 1 Corinthians 14, where Paul says, look, I speak in tongues more than all of you, but I tell you that I would prefer five words. That's the kind of a small number, huh? 5 words with my mind, 5 words that might communicate, rather than myriads upon myriads of words spoken in a tongue. And Paul is not knocking speaking in tongues, he's contexting speaking in tongues. But I think of that as I read Matthew chapter 6. Well, there's other stuff there, not an awful lot, I admit that, but I think that Matthew's gospel is directed against Christian teachers, religiously, I think that's a situation, address against Christian teachers, fellow Christian teachers, fellow inspired prophetic teachers in the church who are being led astray, who are being puffed up, who are becoming arrogant because of the abundance of their gifts and are lording it over the people of God, teaching the people of God to, well, relax this commandment. You don't have to do that kind of stuff anymore. And love is growing cold, and righteousness is going by the board, and anomia or lawlessness is increasing. And for a concluding word here, I'd say look at 23, chapter 23, this terrible tirade against the Pharisees, but look at verses 8 to 10 in chapter 23. Verses 8 to 10. Don't let anybody call you rabbi. You have one didaskalos, namely me. Don't let anybody call you father. You've got a father in heaven. We're all children of the Heavenly Father together. Don't let anybody call you kathegetai.